You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hi, this is Lee Baucom, and you are with us on the Save the Marriage Podcast. And we're on the special edition of the Save the Marriage Podcast. And this special edition is entitled, So You Had an Affair, How to Recover After the Affair. Now, there's a simple reason why we're doing this special edition. It's because last week I did another special edition, and I've got a lot of feedback. Last week's was how to deal with an affair, and it really was focused on the person who had suffered the infidelity. In other words, not the person who committed it, but the one who was had the trust ruptured. And so they're left trying to figure out what to do and how to move forward. So I talked a lot about the pieces of that puzzle, of how to begin to get that back together and how to think about forgiving and how to think about moving beyond that and why you might do that. Well, after that, I got lots of responses from people saying, that's great, but what if you're the one who did have the affair? Not what if you're the one who suffered it? So I realize this is a kind of a specialized audience. You know, it's a smaller grouping that we're talking about who are going to be listening to this. But I want to let you know how clearly I want to speak to you. This is straight talk. There's no punches pulled because my desire is to help you get back to your marriage. Now, not the same marriage you had for years because, let's face it, there is obviously some vulnerability, but to a new place, a new marriage that will sustain itself, that will sustain you and your spouse. So that's the reason for this. Now, I will tell you, after spending about a quarter of a century in the office speaking with couples, I think I've seen every reaction you can have from somebody saying, hey, I had an affair. I remember having one couple that came in, and when the person revealed it, and I didn't even know he had had an affair, but when he revealed it, his wife tore through my office throwing books, pushing over things, just was enraged by that. And I really thought that we were going to have to call for some help, but she began to calm down when she realized that what she was destroying was not her husband's property, but my property. She finally calmed down. And at the other end of that, I remember it was a Valentine's Day, and it will always stick out in my head. I had been working with the man for some time. And by the way, when I talk about it, just because these two examples are men, that does not mean that everybody who has an affair are men. Let's face it, whoever that man is with is often the woman, right? And so I'm just using these as two examples. And so there I was. Having talked with him, I knew about his affair. It had been a one-night stand, but it made him think that maybe his marriage just wasn't meant to be. That's his justification. We'll talk about that in just a bit. And so he was in my office, and it was Valentine's Day. Imagine that, Valentine's Day. His wife is sitting there, and he is talking, and I said, is there anything else you want to say? And I really was not trying to get him to tell her about what he had done. I was simply asking if there was anything else he wanted to say. Well, he did. He revealed the affair, and to my disbelief, because he had told me that he had no intention of talking about that affair. He didn't know what he wanted to do about the marriage, but he knew he didn't want to talk about the affair. And so, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, about what do you do? Do you tell or do you not tell? And I'm going to tell you some reasons why you might go either way. Okay, so there he was, Valentine's Day. And he turns to her and tells her that he had an affair. What I expected to have happen did not happen. She sat there quietly, blinked a few times, and said, oh, I guess I can't really blame you. Now, she could have blamed him, but what she realized is what is true for the predominant number of affairs that happen. They come from disconnected marriages. Now, there are a couple of pieces in that. There's a disconnected marriage that is then not protected by somebody. And so she knew the disconnected part, how disconnected they had been. Well, they worked on their relationship for some time, and they were able to recover the relationship. And oh, by the way, the couple where she tore through my office, they also recovered. Now, I've had others that didn't recover. It's not that there's a kind of a guarantee that you're going to recover, but there are some things that I'm going to tell you that can help that process. And that's really what we're doing, is trying to up the chance that things are going to work out, trying to up the chance that you're going to get back to your relationship. So that's why I want to shoot straight. So let's first talk about what I consider to be the two primary types of affairs. I want to break this down very cleanly, and I did this last week, but if you didn't hear it because it didn't apply to you, this, it applies to you because you're listening. So there are two basic kinds of affairs. Now, there are others, the other subcategories that you might talk about, like revenge affairs, and I have seen that happen where somebody did something wrong, whether it was infidelity or not, and the other person decided the way to teach them a lesson was by having an affair. That's a revenge affair, but that even falls into a category that I'm going to talk about. So first I want to talk about the category that I need to set a parameter around, and then we need to set it aside. If it applies to you, you need to go elsewhere and find some help. And that's the affair that is really based in addiction. It may be addiction to relationships. It may be addiction to sex, but it's addictive, right? And let me also back up and say, I'm going to tell you in just a few minutes that there is an addictive nature to every affair. I would say that we as humans are built for addiction. I mean, that's kind of one of my understandings. And I say that because I'm sitting beside my addictive substance right now. I'm drinking a cup of coffee. It's in the afternoon. I'm drinking a cup of coffee. That's my addiction, caffeine. Others might have sugar or some other substance that's around them. The difference is that my coffee doesn't particularly interfere in anybody's life. Every now and then, my kids kind of roll their eyes when I run into Starbucks while we're at the mall and grab my coffee. But other than that, it really doesn't cause a lot of problems. There are addictions that are more in play than the addictive nature of things. Notice the difference. Some things are addictive, and then some people become addicted. And so let's talk about those who are addicted to relationships or sex. And really, in some ways, it breaks down on gender, but not entirely. So in gross generalities, it tends to be that women are addicted to relationships, that thrill, that rush of a relationship, and men are addicted to sex, generally speaking, when this is the issue. Generally speaking, there are women who have sex addictions, but more often than not, it's men. And men usually are about the sex, not about the relationship, just more often than not. So I'm using gross generalities. How do we know whether an affair was of the addictive type or the other type, which is disconnected relationship type? It's very simple. There is a pattern to that, the pattern to the addiction. It doesn't matter how the marriage is going. If somebody is addicted, they'll go get their fix. And after they get their fix, they go find another fix, and they up the ante. And what you really realize is it has nothing to do with that other person at all. It has to do with getting the fix, getting the hit, getting the dopamine load in the brain. So if you suspect that that might be the case, and here's some reasons why you might suspect it. First is that you are have done things that are more and more thrilling and exciting in the sex, right? So more chances of getting caught or things that might be considered a little off color in sex, and you keep finding that you have to up it. You know, you have to find something more exciting and something, someone more challenging, and some area that's maybe more dangerous, and if it involves, for instance, prostitutes or things like that, then those are pretty clear signs that there's addiction, also when there are multiple affairs. I remember at one point I was having a discussion with a couple, and this person, his wife at that point, was somebody that he had had an affair with on his previous wife, and now he was having another affair. And so I was looking at him going, how many have there been? And there had been four, maybe five. He wasn't going to be clear about that. And I was suspecting that there was more to it. And he said, look, I'm not a philanderer. And I said, what is your definition of that? Because it's exactly your definition of that. I'm not a womanizer, he claimed. A womanizer would be someone who kept going after women. And he's on the fourth or fifth. So we have to realize that sometimes our views of this become a little skewed. So you have to step back just a minute and take a real perspective of this. If there has been more than one affair, certainly if there's been more than two affairs, I began to say, okay, it's time to get an assessment for sexual addiction. That doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but it's time to have an assessment. And here's the nice thing. There's lots of information out there on the internet and in clinics and with different psychologists who can help you understand whether this is addictive just by going through some interview process. Okay, so let's filter those out. If that applies to you, the information I'm going to talk about of what do you do while once you're in recovery, what do you do? It's still going to apply. But the starting point for any addiction is getting into recovery. So if it applies, time to go ahead and find some help and then start restoring your relationship, because otherwise what you end up with is that you're playing around the real issue, around the addiction. And so you regain your partner's trust and you start down this road again. And then what happens? The addiction kicks up again. And you violate the boundaries of the relationship once more. So the starting point for that, for a sexual or a relational addiction, is to get in recovery. Okay, so now that we've kind of bracketed that off, let's talk about the fact that affairs happen because there is disconnection in the relationship, that the real fuel of a marriage is connection. And when that connection is missing, We are, as humans, are built for that connection. We are going to look for it somewhere. And somewhere, generally, it means people. So sometimes we find that feeling of connection through our children, through friends, through work, through sports, through different ways. We can find some people who make us feel like we have connection, but there's still that deep yearning for a connection with that one person. That feeling of wanting to in some ways be embraced and merged with that one person that is wired into us as humans and is what often sends people looking for the other person, or at least makes them vulnerable to that. So the first piece that we have is the disconnection. The second piece we have is the lack of boundaries. Okay, so we don't have connection and we don't have protection. At that point, the relationship is only waiting for the right circumstances for it to be in trouble, if that's the case. So what are the boundaries I'm talking about? Boundaries of how you protect your relationship. You know, of saying, I'm not going to speak to other people about my emotional life. I'll share that with my spouse. I'm not going to meet with someone of the opposite sex in a compromised situation. So I'm not going to meet them at a bar after work, or I'm not going to meet them for dinner. If I'm going to meet them for lunch in a place that is somewhat remote and somehow removed from business, I'm going to make sure there are others present. Those are some boundaries. I'm not going to communicate with an ex-girlfriend or ex-boyfriend on Facebook without the knowledge of my spouse. I'm not going to email. I'm not going to text these other people. I'm not going to share my emotional life at any depth with anyone else. Now, that's a broad statement. You might find you have a best friend that you share that with, but here's the problem. I have heard so many justifications that I know that you're better off overprotecting a bit than underprotecting. Marriages that are affair-proof are connected and protected by boundaries. So if that's where you come from, if you say, okay, the reason this happened is because A, we were not connected, and B, I did not protect it, you have the vast majority of the kind of the normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill affair, if there is such a thing. And that's the kind that is addressable. We can deal with that. And so that brings us to the place of, so what do you do? First, let's understand what happens in this connection. What we know from research is that the connection comes in two different variations. There's the adrenaline connection and the endorphin connection. My friend Bob Grant, a colleague of mine, is the one who kind of put me on to this idea of the difference. Adrenaline, and it's a great way of describing it, adrenaline connection is what happens in the beginning of any relationship. You know, it's that magic of, ooh, we just have so much in common, and I want to see this person, and it feels like you can't stay away from them, right? It's like a moth to the light, and you just feel like you can't stay away. It's a clear sign of adrenaline. Now, this is where I want to shoot straight. You're going to justify that it really was about true love. And I'm going to tell you, it's about adrenaline. And what happens in a relationship over time is that adrenaline has to move to endorphin connection. An endorphin connection is fueled when we do loving things towards the other person. It can include the chemistry. It's not that you suddenly are no longer attracted to this other person, but adrenaline finally burns out. We will burn out our adrenal glands if we were to stay in that same infatuated period that starts every relationship. It's true with a marriage. It's true with an affair. Long enough, the adrenaline will burn through, and suddenly we have to see the person for who they really are. And that's the thing about affairs. We are not looking at this person. You don't look at a person with whom you're having an affair with truthful eyes. You tend to exaggerate the good points and you tend to play down the bad points. You tend to exaggerate the good times and forget the bad times. You live in a fantasy world when you're in an affair. And so what happens is then you use it as a comparison. You know, you pretend like that's real life and marriage, your married life is not. And you forget that married life has kids and bills and jobs and other things. And it's not always about finding a romantic little getaway in a hotel room and sneaking around and going to nice dinners and nice jewelry and flowers and all the other things that we get caught up in. And we say, oh, that's true love. No, that's adrenaline. And the adrenaline is highly addictive. Our brain loves to get a hit of adrenaline and dopamine. Nothing more powerful. The next step down is endorphin and dopamine. The endorphin does a much slower burn on the dopamine load. Dopamine load from adrenaline has to be added onto and added onto and added onto, and it's almost like you're kind of stoking the fire. And that's the problem. You can't keep stoking the fire, and eventually affairs tend to fall apart. And they fall apart for a couple of reasons. One is you finally get past that infatuation and you realize that the person wasn't all that you made them out to be. But the second reason that they don't tend to last is because you realize that that person was willing to be dishonest with you. And how could you ever trust them in the future? I mean, you hatch a relationship in dishonesty. And at some point, you have to face the fact that the dishonesty will bite you in the butt because you can't trust the other person moving forward. That's the nature of affairs. That's why they tend to fall apart. That's why they don't tend to be the ones that make a lasting marriage. They tend to be soaked in dishonesty and deceit. And eventually, that's the death knell of it. See, part of what drives the intensity is that it's hidden and forbidden. I mean, that really is a piece of that whole thing where you have to think about this other person, but you can't talk about it. And so, you know, as before, if you were really establishing a good, strong relationship, you'd be telling your friends about it, tell them how wonderful he or she is. But in affair, you have to keep it quiet. And when you keep it quiet, it's like putting it in a pressure cooker. It builds up. The pressure builds, the pressure builds, the pressure builds, and it makes it all seem more powerful than it really is. So that's the part that's behind it is that it's hidden and forbidden, and it creates a us versus the world mentality. Everybody's going to be opposed to our relationship. They're not going to understand it's true love. I've heard this one many times. Okay, so that brings us to the justifications. Sometimes people say, well, you know, I didn't get my need met in the relationship, so I did it there. That's a justification. Justification. Because that's assuming that you couldn't get it met in the marriage. And it's also assuming that it's a need that has to be met. Because if you're talking about sex, you may have to recalculate that piece and say, wow, is that really something that I had to have the way I wanted it when I wanted it? Was that not me playing ego piece? Because that's where it comes from in affairs. Some people tell me, well, it's just physical. There is no such thing. I talked about this in the last actual podcast, not the special edition, but the last actual podcast where I talked about sex and marriage. And I talked about the fact that that sex for humans is never just physical. We know it from study after study that shows that there is a connection that's formed between people who have sex that is not in any other connection. It's not just physical. think about the times you know people who had sexual partners outside before they were married, perhaps in their younger years, and they always have some kind of connection with that person. Why? Because it's woven into the act of sex as humans. So if you want to hear more about that, go hear the podcast on marriage and sex, and that'll give you kind of a mindset of why that's the case and how what happens with us physically. So it's not just physical. That's just justification. It's true love is the other one. And this is a difficult one for people to let go of. They want to believe that they found true love and they've left it behind, because what they tend to compare is the beginning of this relationship with the kind of the tail end of the marriage. Instead of comparing where you are now at the beginning with where you were now at the beginning of your marriage, you know, you compare them at equal points. Some people go, oh, gosh, I didn't realize that. And I've had this happen many times where people come into my office and said, you know, I found this the person of my dreams, the man of my dreams, the woman of my dreams, and my spouse is nothing like them. And I said, well, tell me about them. And they tell me about them. I said, well, tell me about your spouse when you first got together. And they tell me, I'm like, it's the same feelings you're experiencing. But now you're comparing an issue-laden relationship where you haven't dealt with the pains and the hurts with one that's fresh and doesn't have any pains and hurts to be dealt with yet. They'll come. They come with any relationship. But we use the justification, oh, it's true love. It is not true love when it's based in dishonesty and deceit. That is an antecedent to having any kind of real love. You're involved in another relationship and having this one, it's not true love. It's infatuation at that point, and it's fueled by adrenaline, and it's built in deceit. So how could it be true love? That's not how you do that. And then people say, I never felt this way before. To which I say, our brain tricks us very often. You may not remember feeling this way, but guess what? You won't remember feeling this way next time, because the only time we remember this state in our brain is when we're in it at that moment. Our brain is so full of chemicals in that infatuation period that it completely clouds out how we used to feel at other points. When we've talked about that idea madly in love, what we know from brain studies and from chemistry studies is that it's literal. A person who isn't in that infatuation period shows very similar brain function as someone who really is crazy, who really has some mental illness. The brain is so overcooked in adrenaline and overcooked in dopamine and overcooked in all of these firings of the neurons that you say, I've never felt this way before. And what you're doing is fooling yourself into thinking that, forgetting that you have a hard time remembering how it felt before. So those are the justifications that tend to get people stuck on the affair. So it's real simple. How do you break that addictive feel? You got to get away from the addiction. And here's the tough part. You don't want to. I know that from hearing people tell me about their relationship. You don't want to break that off because it feels like you're giving something up. So I don't know how many times the person has said to me after an affair, after they, you know, I've said, you've got to break off the relationship. And they struggle with that, and they struggle with that, and they finally break off communication. And it takes about 3 to 6 weeks. But somewhere in that 3 to 6 week mark, they come in and they say, I don't know what I was thinking. This person is possessive and angry and vindictive, and they're not attractive. And they go, and the list goes on. But they can't see it while the adrenaline clouds their eyes. They can't see it while the dopamine fix is making the love blind. And I use love in quotes. Infatuation is what's blind. Love is wide-eyed, wide-open, looking at who the person really is and saying, that's the person I love. Infatuation is that everything is good and that you have a need that you won't met. That's the difference between the two. So we get stuck in that place of justifying. Okay, so let's say that you are you're hearing me, and maybe it's hurting a little bit for me to be this blunt and honest, but that's why I'm here. And you raise the question, so what do I do? I've had the affair, my spouse doesn't know yet. Okay, I'm going to tackle that one first because that's at the beginning point. Do I tell or do I not tell? Okay, so let's just set that as a frame that has actually been studied. And the studies have shown that whether you tell or you don't tell, the outcome can be the same. The outcome can fall apart, or the outcome can be to come together. So telling is not a guarantee that it's going to work out, and not telling is not a guarantee that it's going to work out. Neither one are a guarantee. Both can work for or against you. And so I have some questions for you to ask yourself. Why are you going to tell, or why are you going to not tell? Because that begins to let us know what the motivation is about. Some people will say to me, I can't tell my spouse because my spouse has already said, if you have an affair, if you ever have an affair, I will leave you. And that person says, I am 100% convinced that my spouse is telling me the truth. So if I want to save the marriage, I cannot tell. Okay, so that's one category. Then there are those who say, you know, my spouse and I treasure the most being honest and open. And even though it may hurt, I think we can work through this. Okay, that would be a reason to tell. Sometimes I have people who tell me, I don't want to have to carry this around in my gut, in my heart, to which I would say, that's not the reason to tell or not to tell. If you're feeling guilty and your way of relieving guilt is to tell, that's not the reason to do it. If you have done the wrong, then you have to decide whether it's going to be helpful to tell or not to tell. Don't do it because you want to get it off your chest. And I know what some people are going to say. They're going to say, well, you know, I've heard it said that confession is good for the soul. And that comes from the Catholic Church that wanted people to go confess to the priest. Not that we have to confess to everyone. And by the way, the soul, it's not good for the soul like it makes you feel better. It's good for the soul like you might get to go to heaven. That's the meaning behind that. So let's be clear about what that means when you're going to use that as a justification. So instead, the question is, whose need is being met by that? If it's a relational need, we've got to be honest and open, and that's how we'll get through this, then that's a reason to tell. But if it's your need to get it off your chest because you don't want to have to carry it around, all you're doing is handing the load of crap over to your spouse to carry around. And there is incredible pain associated in the telling. So whether you tell or you don't tell, you need to ask yourself, why am I going to do that? And whose need am I trying to deal with? And finally, what is the desired outcome I want out of that? Because when you make a decision on that, that decision is final. Let me be clear about that. If you say, yeah, I can't tell, then I want to say to you, you have to take that to your grave with you. And if you say, I will tell, you will have to take that decision through the rest of your life also. Either way, it goes with you forward. A few times I've had people who had an affair, they decided not to tell, they recover the relationship. 5-10 years later, it's eaten at them, and they finally decide they've got to come clean, and they come clean, and the marriage ends. Why? Because suddenly everything has been a lie in the eyes of the spouse. So if you decide not to tell, realize that's a lifetime decision, and then you have to decide you're going to live your life with that peace as the motivator to step up into a different place in your life, to a higher place, that you're going to live differently and use that as a learning point, motivation to do it differently. So you want to make sure at that point, then you live your life not just at a higher point for all your life, but in terms of your relationship, of how you will make sure that that never happens again, how you will make sure that you never put it at risk again, which brings us to step one, which is raising your personal standard. Somewhere along the way, you allowed yourself, probably, I would assume for most people, if you're listening to this, I would assume that, you broke your own standard of what you expected of yourself. I don't have many people who say, you know what, I set out to have an affair. I was just going to go do that. I headed out to the bar. I headed out to wherever. I, you know, met this person for lunch and dinner and whatever. I did it because I was going to find somebody. There are those people out there. They are not on this call because they are not really working on their relationship. That's a whole different category. That often is about the first category I talked about addiction. If you sought out an affair, not found yourself falling into an affair, that's a clear symptom of the addiction. So if you found yourself caught up in a process, then you say, okay, what are the standards I need to set for myself? The new standard that I'm going to be protective of the relationship, that I'm going to be protective of my own boundaries. I'm not going to let anybody get to me by flattery or by perseverance or, you know, sexy pictures or whatever came your way, that you raise your standard that you're going to be above that. And I think there's strong potential to raise your standard because we all have room. I'm constantly going, okay, what's my next standard to raise to? How can I go after a higher point in life? Whether it's my physical life, my mental life, my spiritual life, my psychological life, I'm looking, what is the next standard for me to step into? And I'm inviting you to use this as a time to say, okay, what's the next standard for me to step into? Because you got to raise the standard to make sure that you insulate from that ever happening again. Then you want to begin to set the boundaries of the relationship. What do you need to do to make sure you don't get into that place again? These are the boundaries, not what do you need to do about the connection in the relationship to make sure that the connection area, this is the protection part. Do you stay away from a certain point? You know, I know some people who say, I'm going to stop business travel because that puts me at risk. I'm going to stop hanging out at the sports bar because that puts me at risk. I'm going to stop going dancing because that puts me at risk. I'm going to stop Facebooking this person because it puts me at risk. I'm going to and boundaries are about that. I'm going to stop that. I'm going to protect the relationship. This is a golden opportunity for you and your spouse as a couple to say, what do we need to do to draw the clear boundaries around our relationship? What do we need to do to protect that? Not what do we need to do to reconnect. This is a what do we need to do to protect it? Because the connection is going to take some effort. With a spouse who has been hurt, where the trust has been ruptured, understand it's going to take some time and effort to rebuild that. So first we're saying, where are the places you need to automatically create protection? Because the protection needs to be in place, whether the connection is anywhere to be seen. They are separate issues. When we marry, if you had the same vows that I did, we made a promise to forsake all others. What we didn't make a promise is to always feel gushy and connected with our spouse, but to always forsake all others. So the first place is to say, how do we then do that? How do we forsake all others? How do we make sure that we protect that part of our life? And that includes our emotional and our physical connection, so that it is not at risk anymore. And this is where, you know, I talked about, if you haven't read my Save the Marriage system, you want to look at that. Save the Marriage system, you can find that at savethemarriage.com. And when I talk about that, I talk about the fact that the North Star of your relationship is commitment, that you can rely on the commitment to take you through when you're not feeling all the warm feelings that you once felt. I've heard it said that a commitment is what you agree to do when you no longer feel the way you did when you made that agreement. That's commitment. So now I'm asking you, what do you need to do to create the protection of that? Be specific in your mind. How do you need to interact with other people? Where do you not need to be? Where do you need to be? How do you need to maintain accountability? How do you need to make sure that those pieces are in place? That's step one. Okay, step two is becoming transparent with your spouse. You know, after the trust is ruptured, you realize one very central thing. Trust is a gift. It's always a gift. The reason I say that is because some people will make trust very, very costly. They won't trust people. Other people make trust way too cheap. They'll trust anyone. So one never lets anybody in, and one always lets everybody in. Okay, and how does that apply to this? Well, when somebody has an affair, it ruptures the trust. At some point, a spouse is going to have to say, okay, I'm going to learn to trust you again. I'm going to decide to trust you again. In other words, I'm going to begin to give you the gift of trust. But your role is to treasure it. You can't earn somebody's trust. You can protect the trust they give you, or you can destroy the trust they give you. You can't earn it because at some point they have to give it, but you can be trustworthy. And part of what's trustworthy is being transparent, becoming transparent about where you are, what you're doing, who you're with, and what's happening there. And unfortunately, because of the affair, you're going to have to put up with some of the feelings in a spouse of them needing to play detective, of checking up on you. Now, in the other audio, when I was talking about what do you do about an affair, I suggested that whoever suffered the affair be very careful about the questions they ask and to not play detective. And I'm giving the opposite advice for the person who had the affair. Be transparent and try to let the other person see everything. So if they text you and say, hey, where are you? You tell them. And if they say, what are you doing? You tell them. And if they need reassurance, you recognize that's the cost. That's the bitter medicine. That's what it's going to take to rebuild this. So being transparent may mean that you have to hand over the phone whenever it's asked without there being a whole lot of deleted texts and numbers, because guess what? Most people can look on the record and say, why are these numbers deleted? Why does your number of texts not match? You might have to give up your email password. I've already told the person who had the affair or who suffered the affair to not be going and always looking at the phone and always looking at emails, but you should have the right to do that, the opportunity to do that, and you've got to give the spouse the opportunity to do that. If they say, I want to see your Facebook messaging, you turn it right around, not like, well, let me give you my computer in a day or in an hour, or let me turn it on first, let me log in first. You let them do that. And you find ways of being 100% transparent, knowing that that doesn't have to be true forever, but it has to be true long enough for your spouse to say, okay, I see that you have changed. And by the way, you will have needed to have changed. You will have needed to have raised your standard to become somebody different for your spouse to say, okay, now, because your spouse is going, what's going to be different? And there are only a couple of options. And the only one that matters is what's going to be different is you realize that you've got to be different in the world, that you've got to have a higher standard, that you've got to have more clear boundaries, that you've got to protect the relationship. And until that happens, your spouse is going to be stuck feeling like there's always that chance. So in the beginning, I said that it's based in the fact that there were no boundaries and that there was no connection or not enough connection, and that you didn't have your standards set high enough to avoid it. So you've raised your standards. You've created the boundaries, right? Now you have to create the connection. It's going to take some effort because a spouse who's been burned is going to be less desirous of being connected. So you have to work on that slowly. So the last thing I suggest you do is you find a way of creating accountability, finding a friend who will hold you accountable so that your spouse doesn't have to always hold you accountable. That's a tough role, because when we're talking about accountability from a spouse, at some point you can end up resenting the spouse who's only trying to protect the relationship. But you act as if they're, you know, playing sheriff and judge. And by the way, that's a place that you've earned it. Remember, I told you, bitter medicine. This is where it gets tough. And so finding some other place for accountability. There are men's accountability groups all over the place. There are women's groups that function the same way. A good friend, a best friend who you can say, hey, I need you to know this happened, and I need you to be asking me, are you holding up your end of the bargain? Accountability is crucial for making sure that you know somebody's going to hold you accountable, and it doesn't have to just be your spouse. Okay, so that's a lot of tough medicine coming at you, a lot of tough stuff. I hope that you've heard me shoot pretty straight with you. And here's the reason. I think that marriages can come out on the other side of an affair stronger than they went in. I think that many marriages can make it through an affair and actually use that as impetus for being a much stronger relationship than it was before, if you use it as an opportunity for growth and change. If you don't, if you try to sidestep it, if you try to play it down, if you try to justify it, it will become a cancer and eat away at the relationship. If you face it head on and you make yourself trustworthy, you raise your standards of your own personal standards, you create the boundaries of the relationship, and you create accountability, you suddenly are at a new point of saying, okay, I've got to move beyond this. You'll have to forgive yourself. You have to seek the forgiveness of your spouse, but you can make it a stronger relationship. I didn't say you will. I said you can. This is your opportunity. Don't let a mistake weigh you down. Don't let a mistake mark your life. Instead, rise above that. See this as a place where you can create a relationship that is a fair proof and that is one that you will treasure for the rest of your life. This is Lee Balcom, and I wish you the best as you work to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.